This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Hello, this is Liz Guzman and I'm here with Dr. Paolo Padovani from ESO, the European Southern Observatory in Munich, Germany. He gave a talk about radio deep sky and the solution to a 50-year-old puzzle. Hello, Paolo. Thank you for being with us.
Hi.
So for a start, tell us about what was the puzzle that you solved.
The puzzle has to do with the discovery of quasars, which were discovered almost 50 years ago by Monty Schmidt in the US. And he discovered quasars as the optical counterparts of strong radio sources at the time. But then he was quickly realized that there were many sources in the sky very similar to quasars with very strong, broad lines, but which were not radio sources. They were not detected by the radio telescopes at the time. They were called radio quiet.
Okay.
It was realized later on that these radio quiet quasars are not radio quiet. They're just radio weak. Okay. They do emit in the radio band, but much less than the other ones. And the other ones are the classical radio galaxies, which we see that people study here in Manchester, for example. And so for about 50 years, people have been debating what's behind radio emission in these radio weak sources. And we discovered, we realized by studying them in the radio band, that they are not powered by the jets, the strong jets, which we see in the other sources, but their radio emission is due to processes related to star formation. Stars evolve, they become older, they die, they become supernovae, they make supernova remnants, and particles in these remnants, since they're moving in magnetic fields, they emit synchrotron radiation, which is seen as the radio band. So in these sources, the radio emission has to do with star formation related processes.
Okay. So to clarify this, so you have, there's mainly three different sources that you have here. So it's AGNs, which is active galactic nuclei, and then radio loud and radio quiet.
Correct.
Okay, so can you explain us a little bit, like, the difference between these three? So how to differentiate this one?
So the AGN, we know AGN are things where at the center there is a black hole.
Okay.
Something which emits a lot of energy. People think that black holes are good at sucking in things, but many people realize that actually they are also good at emitting a lot of radiation. Quasars are some of the brightest sources in the universe because they have black holes at the center. So a minority of these quasars emit most of the energy in forms of jets. Jets are stringy, long things on the sky that emit radiation at all bands, from the radio, infrared, optical, and X-ray. Mm-hmm. The majority of this AGN, for some reason which you still don't understand, is not capable of producing these jets.
Okay.
They don't have any jets. They still do have radio emission, but the radio emission is coming from processes to do with star formation.
Okay.
And then we have star-forming galaxies, where there is no black hole, or the black hole is actually dormant, not doing much, like our own Milky Way. There is a black hole at the center. It's not doing anything. Mm-hmm. And these things emit in the radio band synchrotron radiation, again, due to star formation processes.
Okay. So you have the radio loud, which are the ones with jets, and they have an active nuclei.
Correct.
So the black hole in the center is very active.
Correct.
And it's emitting a lot of energy, but you also have really big jets.
Correct.
Okay, and the radio quiet ones, you have emission from the disk, I guess, which is the...
You still have a black hole, but for some reason, the black hole is not very good at emitting in the radio band.
Okay.
And emits mostly from the disk in the optical ultraviolet band.
Yeah. Is this an evolutionary trend? I mean, does AGNs will become radio quiet and radio loud, or are they different objects?
That's a very good question. I don't know the answer to that. Some people have ideas about it. I don't think there is any strong suggestion that this is the case.
Okay.
What we did do, and this is how we got to the conclusion that how we solved the puzzle, we studied the evolution in the radio band, how things evolve, so how their power changes with time for star-forming galaxies and radio-quiet AGN and radio-loud AGN. And we discovered that star-forming galaxies at the GN evolve in exactly the same way, which means that the process behind the radio emission has to be the same, unlike the radio loading GN, which are completely separate. And it makes a posteriori perfect sense, because radio quad GN typically are in spiral galaxies, so the black hole has a galaxy around. The galaxy is forming stars. So you will have supernova remnants, and you will have radio emission coming from them. So a posteriori is not a big deal, but took about 50 years to solve.
Yeah, once something is solved, it's like, yeah, it was really easy, right? Brilliant. That's really interesting. Okay, so first of all, you have a lot of surveys. You had all these objects. So I guess one of the main thing is how to differentiate between each other. So I guess what you have, you mentioned a lot of multi-wavelength surveys.
In the old days, as I mentioned in my talk, you had the survey, surveying a given band, say X-ray or radio. To identify your sources, you could spend 10 years because you had a small sample and they were bright. You go into telescopes and observe them one by one. And by looking at the optical spectrum, you could tell this is a galaxy, an elliptical galaxy. This is a quasar with broad lines, with narrow lines, and so forth. Nowadays, things are changing. Well, for two reasons. One is that many surveys are really huge, and you don't have the time to do that. Mm-hmm. In our case, our survey is not big, but it goes really, really deep. Yeah. So once you want to do that, and you want to go to an optical telescope, and you observe these things, they're too faint.
Yeah.
It would take you, say, days of observing, and nobody's going to give you that time, because telescope time is expensive. Yeah. So what we did, we found an alternative way of using all sorts of data, because the area we studied is really, really well studied. So we had X-ray, infrared, optical, and radio data. And we found a process by which, using all this data, you can classify sources based on their known properties. This is what we did. And this is very relevant, again, in Manchester, because deeper radio surveys are going to face even tougher problems, because their optical counterparts are going to be even fainter.
Yeah.
And so you won't be able to identify them classically. You have to use a similar method.
Yeah. You mentioned the evolutionary map of the universe.
Yes.
That's a survey.
It's a survey which is part of the ASCAP, which is Australian Escape Pathfinder. It's an Australian survey which includes many people, including myself and a couple of people here in Manchester. Mm-hmm. So that survey is going to go as deep as we did on an area, though, which is 150,000 times bigger.
Oh, wow.
So while we detected 200 sources, it's going to detect 60 million sources.
That's going to be tough.
And half of them are going to be quasars.
Yeah.
So that means 30 million quasars. Now, the number of known quasars until now is about 200,000. It's not even a million. So it's going to be a huge change. But these things are potential numbers because, as I mentioned, they're going to be faint. You're going to need lots of data to identify them, but you won't have the data over the whole sky. Yeah. You'll have them in small areas. So in small areas, you're okay. In other areas, you have to find clever and different ways to understand what's going on.
Yeah. Brilliant. And this is before SKA, right? So
exactly. SKA is going to go even deeper.
Yeah.
And so the problems are going to be, well, on one hand, an SKA image, as I mentioned in my talk, an SKA image covering an area which is a factor of 300 larger than our area is going to detect as many quasars as we know today.
Wow.
Just that.
Yeah.
And if you go to a bit bigger thing, you get recently a million quasars. But the problem is the SKA is going to go really deep.
Yeah.
And so the problems I mentioned today are going to be amplified.
Yeah.
So again, either radio astronomy becomes completely independent and they're going to classify things and getting redshifts all from the radio band, which I think is going to be difficult, or, as usual, we'll have to, some areas are going to be better studied than others and we'll do some things, and other areas we'll have to do less. That's as simple as that.
Yeah, amazing things are coming, right? I also wanted to ask you about the ELT. So tell us about it. What is it and what is it going to do?
Okay, the ELT, which is what I'm working on at the moment at ESO in Germany, means extremely large telescope.
Yeah.
It's the largest optical telescope, so telescope optical near infrared, looking in the optical near infrared band, ground based, the largest in the world. Now, right now, the biggest telescope which is seeing optical light, the light that we see with our eyes, is 10 meters in diameter. Yeah. This is going to be 39 meters in diameter.
Wow.
Made up of thousands of 1 meter hexagons,
yeah,
connected all together and managed by a computer which is going to tell the hexagons how to move and how to behave in real time so that you have a perfect image. Amazingly complicated, never done before, and it's going to be a huge thing. You're going to be able to see really, really deep in the universe.
Okay, so this telescope is similar to SALT, right, which is a telescope in South Africa.
Yes.
That uses these adaptive optics that
exactly
has different hexagons and
they yes
put it all together. But this is pretty much four times bigger.
Yes.
So this is, okay. And what are you going to observe? I mean, I'm guessing it's very faint objects as well.
Yes, there are various, well, you know, there are various, you know, big areas. One of them is planets.
Okay, extrasolar planets.
Extrasolar planets. This thing is, the resolution of this thing is going to be so large, much better than the Hubble, yeah, that you're going to be actually able to see small, tiny planets close to their stars.
Oh, wow.
So you're going to need a lot of, you know, clever engineering, but that's one of the plans. So being able to see planets not much, not almost Earth-like, a bit bigger than Earth, but around nearby stars. That's going to be an amazing thing.
That sounds amazing. Yeah, I mean, at the moment with Kepler has detected a lot of exoplanets, but most of the techniques are indirect.
Indirect, correct.
So they don't see the planet, right? But with the ELT, we're kind of trained to get the planet.
Correct, and maybe getting a spectrum of them, which is really amazing, because you can see the atmosphere, right, as well.
Of course.
Another big thing, I think, this is my biased view, is, you know, about the expansion of the universe, right? We know it, we see it, we have many arguments about it. One of the major projects of the ELT is actually measuring the expansion of the universe by looking at quasar spectra over 20 years' time.
Wow.
And so that should give you a direct measurement of the way that the universe is expanding.
Well, that sounds really interesting.
Yeah.
So normally, well, so far we have measured the expansion using supernova, right? So with quasars, you're aiming to measure the distances between them, or?
You're looking, from what I understand,
yeah,
you're looking at their lines.
Yeah.
And as time goes by, you see the effect that the expansion of the universe has on their broad lines.
Okay.
But you need a huge time frame. So it's a project which is going to last more than 20 years.
Okay.
So that's one of the reasons why this telescope has to be up and running for a while.
Yeah. Very good news that it just got accepted this week, right?
Yes, on Monday.
On Monday.
Yes.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Brilliant. Well, thank you very much for the interview. Thank you for the talk. Very interesting.
Okay, thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.